From our studios around the world, this is Eat Well, Travel Better, the Business of Food Travel podcast. Every month, we bring you the world's culinary tourism industry professionals and share with you strategies, tactics, and information that help make you a more effective leader, communicator, and professional in our culinary tourism industry. I'm your host, Eric Wolf. Thanks for listening. Welcome to episode 58. Today, we will be speaking with Nancy Matsumoto. Nancy Matsumoto is an award-winning writer and editor who covers food, drink, regenerative agriculture, and Japanese culture. She is the co-author of Exploring the World of Japanese Craft Sake, Rice, Water, Earth, and the forthcoming By the Shore of Lake Michigan, an English-language translation of a Japanese poetry anthology that she edited. Her articles have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, NPR, Civil Eats, Savour, Food and Wine, and Air Canada's En Route, among other publications. Nancy, welcome to the Business of Food Travel podcast, and thank you for being on the show today. Nancy, when I was looking at your materials before I was introduced to you, the first thing that caught my eye is that you write for Air Canada's En Route magazine and their November food issue every year, and that is such a fantastic resource. How did you get started writing for En Route?
Oh, it's nice of you to say that about the magazine. I agree. It's a wonderful in-flight magazine. I am not a native Canadian. I'm actually Japanese American, but my husband is Canadian. And I've lived in this country a couple times during my life. So the second time I came up in late 2016, and it was kind of a by chance thing in a way, because one of our friend's daughter happened to work at En Route at the time. And I think she first invited me to pitch stories. And I did a story on sake makers in Japan who were sort of taking their cues from French winemaking. And it was a sort of a really interesting take on where sake was going. And that worked out really well. And then she kind of called me up and said, you know, I want to talk to you about this confidential thing, but we'd like you to try out for this Air Canada's top 10 new restaurant gig. And so I actually had to go to a restaurant and write a sample review. And luckily they liked it enough. I got the job. The previous fellow who had been doing it did it for 5 years and had a great time, but I think he had had enough of so much travel in such a short period of time. So I did it in 2018 and 2019. And I'm doing it again this year, but nothing has been published yet. We publish a long list of our favorite 30 in mid-August. And then in the early November, the top 10 is revealed. It hasn't been done for the last 2 years. So I'm not sure. In the past, they've done sort of a big gala where all the top 10 chefs and teams get to fly out to Toronto and go to a big gala. I don't even know if they're going to do that this year. And it was quite different after not doing it for 2 years and staff changes. And it was kind of a very different experience, but still incredibly fun. It was grueling too, because I happened to have booked a Spain trip in the middle of it. So we had to abbreviate something like 35 restaurants into less than a month, really. So there were some cities where I would fly in and I would have to go to a lunch. And then a few hours later, I'd have to go to a dinner. So it's a marathon at the eating. But at the same time, you're seeing the country. My husband always jokes that he's the Canadian and I've seen more of Canada than he has, which is really true. I've gone to some very remote, beautiful places.
Well, I remember someone had told me about En Route magazine's November issue many, many years ago, and I happened to be on an Air Canada flight one November, I guess, I don't know, it was maybe 2013 or 2014, and I saw the issue, and I was absolutely blown away. I mean, it was extra thick, and it was just, you know, if you're talking about someone who loves food and travel, it was just made in heaven, and I couldn't stop reading it, and I took extra copies from the backs of the seats, and I shared them with friends, and I used them in speeches as best practices examples. And I really recommend to anyone if you can get your hands on it. But I guess now it's digital. Is that right?
There will be a print issue. And in fact, I believe it's the only print issue they're going to do all year, because it is such a sort of a flagship brand for the magazine. But since COVID, they haven't had it in seat backs, which is very sad. And when they were publishing it, it would be inserts in like the Globe and Mail in certain demographics. So it was harder to find. But yeah, it's considered, I mean, it's won a lot of journalism awards over the years because it's beautifully photographed. We usually do extensive videos on the top restaurants, top several restaurants. So they're wonderful video packages, and so it's print, but there's also digital only components. So like this year, I'll write two digital pieces that will not go in the magazine. But traditionally, that November issue has had a lot of food content. So you're right, it's kind of a treasure trove if you're a food lover. And even before I ever knew that I would work for this magazine, my husband and I would use it as our guide when traveling around Canada to pick where we were going to eat, both the long list and the top 10. So it's quite influential in that way. It's a wonderful thing to be associated, and I feel very, very lucky to have been able to do it for this long.
Well, I'm glad they're going to bring back a print issue this year. There's just something about food and travel. I just can't get into it in a digital format. It just doesn't, I think, have the same impact. I'll skim it, but it doesn't really make me want to travel. I think the way holding it in your hands does.
I agree. There's something special and tactile about that.
Exactly. Yeah. But hey, you had talked a little bit about sake in your opening, and when I finally met you, when we were talking about whether it was a good fit to bring you onto the show, you'd sent me a preview copy of your new book, and it's just come out, Exploring the World of Japanese Craft Sake, Rice, Water, Earth. I had a look at that, and I was awestruck about how professional, but how comprehensive, how easy to understand all of the information was. And I think for me, not knowing really that much about Japan or sake, it was eye-opening. I mean, I had no idea about all the different permutations and levels and all the quality controls and checks, and it was just amazing. And wow, congratulations on such a fantastic book.
Oh, this makes me so happy to hear you say these things. Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. It was kind of a labor of love. It took a number of years. We really wanted to, I have a co-writer, Michael Tremblay, who's a sake sommelier and educator here in Toronto at a restaurant called Key Modern Japanese. But we teamed up because we both had been thinking about doing a book on sake. Being a journalist, I'm all about the stories behind the craft, the people, the generational brewers, the farmers. We have a whole chapter on women master brewers. We have a chapter on recipes collected from brewing families, which I think is really makes it fun and interactive. And the families also recommended their favorite pairings, so that's really fun. We have a whole chapter on our favorite sake bar crawls in Japan. But our goal starting out was really we wanted to be able to reach people from the absolute newcomer to sake who knows nothing to someone who's a real aficionado, even sake professionals. So we wanted it to have something for everyone. So the first 30 pages are infographics that you kind of can dip in and out of to learn the basics, just how is sake made? It's brewed with a very few ingredients, rice, water, koji cane, which is the fungus or the mold that's used to help convert the starch into sugar, and then yeast to ferment the sugars. We go into things like serving styles, temperatures, classifications. We talk about pairings. It's really kind of a sake basics. And then the next part of the book, which is the bulk of the book, is really the narrative where we're talking about the elemental ingredients of sake. And then we have the whole second half is the what we call the agents of change. So, we talk to people who are the yeast scientists, developing new yeast. We talk to the little-known people who really cultivate that fungus and they're selling it commercially to not just sake makers, but every fermented food in Japan. I shouldn't say every, but the vast majority rely on this very specific type of fungus. So when you get soy sauce or miso or mirin, all of these things use the same. So these merchants are quite powerful. Anyway, it's kind of like the story of the people behind it, and then the Master Brewing Guild and the brewers and the just in the whole world, really, we're trying to. And then we kind of also try to show how really telling the story of sake is kind of telling the story of Japan. both go back to Shinto and even pre-Shinto Japan, where sake appears in the folklore and mythology of Japan as the drink of the gods, to the Edo period in starting in about 1600, where there was this huge boom in economic activity, and sake knowledge and technique also really advanced a lot, to the way the national tax system is closely tied to sake rice growing. And yet at one point, sake composed about a third of the revenue, tax revenue of the country. And so you would get these expert scientists who basically worked for the national tax agency, but they would go out and advise brewers on the best practices and new ways to brew sake. So tied with the culture and history of Japan. And I really wanted to sort of tell that story and show people it's not just this interesting drink. It's so much more. It's part of the culture and history of Japan.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the World Food Travel Association's Culinary Capitals Program. Did you know that 72% of travelers choose a destination based on its food and drink? Now is the perfect time for smaller, lesser-known destinations to get on the radar of the world's food lovers. But travelers can't find the next great food destination if they don't know anything about it. The Culinary Capitals Program helps put smaller destinations on the map and keeps them top of mind for food and beverage-loving travelers. Get in touch with us at help@worldfoodtravel.org and learn how your destination can become a culinary capital today. What I really liked about the book is that you brought together the culture, the history, and even a look at the future of sake all in one tome. And I almost wish that this was part of a series where, whether you like gelato or blue cheese or insert your favorite food here, it was almost encyclopedic.
What a great idea.
Yeah. What would be your next book?
Well, I love that idea. I mean, I think you could do this treatment on any number of interesting food or beverage items. But one of the things I write a lot about is regenerative agriculture. I really see it as part of covering food, because sake itself is an agricultural product. And it was really one of the things that first attracted me to it and made me want to go to the farmers and talk to them about, you know, what it's like to grow sake rice. But because I write a lot about agriculture, and especially farmers who are trying to regenerate the land to improve the ecosystems, not just the land, but the entire ecosystems around them, I'm hoping that my next book will relate to food and agriculture. And I'm working on a proposal right now. So maybe one day I'll get to tell you more about that.
Well, we will put the link to your website in the show notes so people can have a look. But the pedigree that you of articles that you've published, you talk about the African farmer growing rice in New York's Hudson Valley. That was really interesting. Or the indigenous foods in Canada one, I thought was really interesting as well. But you have some really, really interesting articles here. Do you come up with these ideas, or are these assigned to you?
I would say it's a mix of both. Sometimes editors will come to me and ask me to write a story. The editors of Civil Eats, which is a wonderful online magazine that covers food and agriculture and food systems, it's based in the US. They approached me to do the African rice farmer story, and they conceived of it as they're getting into doing little movies. So it became sort of a video and a story, which so it was very fun to work with a photographer and videographer. In many cases, I will pitch the idea. I did a story in Mexico about farmers who are trying to revive this ancient crop of amaranth, which was kind of wiped out after the conquistadors came. And it's a shame because it's extremely nutritious. It's native. It grows really well. And so it was kind of a way to bring back food sovereignty to farmers in Mexico. And I had come across this organization that was working on this, and I really wanted to write about it. So I pitched it. NPR used to have a wonderful channel called The Salt that did food but in a sort of food stories, but in a very international outlook and often very environmentally focused as well. So I pitched it to them and ended up doing the story for them. Like the sake story I mentioned, I pitched it, but I've done other en route stories. They asked me to do a story on interesting sort of eco food ways developing in Ireland. And that was a really fun one. But then I just happened to be on vacation in the Canary Islands with my husband. And we fell in love with the wines of the Canary Islands. Luckily, because I'm just such a, I guess, a compulsive note taker after being a journalist all my life, you know, I took a lot of notes. I wasn't on assignment or anything. And then several years later, I was talking to my editor and I said, this is a great story. It's about a wonderful winemaker in Tenerife who basically brought back all of these defunct grape varieties that had just no one had used, and they had mutated from what they were when the Portuguese or Spanish or Italians brought them. And so they were unique to the Canary Islands. And it's such a wonderful sort of time capsule story. Also, the Canary Islands never fell prey to phylloxera. And so they have these very old growth vines. So it's unique in so many ways, volcanic soil. So I ended up doing a story on those, which won an award. And but it's just like, so you're kind of living your life and you never know when you're going to come across an interesting story. I guess that's the lesson.
Is that article on your list of articles on your website?
Yeah, it's on my website. And also, I believe I linked to the article on the En Route website too, so you can see both versions.
Yeah, because living in Spain right now, I am very attuned to all of the wines that you just don't see exported. I live in the Alicante region south of Valencia, and there's some wines that there's such small production, but they're just fantastic and they're not expensive. I mean, I think if you spent about, oh, I don't know, $8 or $9 for a bottle, that would be an expensive bottle.
I know.
And
It's
they're just
so
so
true in the
good.
Canaries too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're very lucky to live there.
I want to go back to your book for a second. I am of the school that we learn something new every day, and I'm just wondering, an experienced journalist like yourself, did you learn anything new in the process of putting together that entire book?
I would say it was really fun and challenging. I guess it gave me the confidence to just know. It seemed very organic and natural to me. We kind of had it outlined because when you write a book proposal to sell an idea to a publisher, you have to pretty ma much map it out chapter by chapter. And what was nice about this project is we pretty much stuck to the roadmap that I had made of what stories we were going to tell. I don't know what, I mean, I guess it's maybe a little bit like putting together a film or something where you have episodes or scenes that you want, you know, you want to get in, and then you look at it thematically. How are we going to organize it thematically? And then in order to get all these particular great stories of either breweries or regions or you know, just on the subject of rice, we knew we wanted to talk about two varieties of rice and we devoted a chapter to each. It just seemed very organic. And I guess all I can think is that maybe it's just kind of like the same thing I've been doing my whole career, which is telling a story and figuring out how to order it in order to make it fun and interesting and draw people in, but applying that onto a much larger canvas of a book. So it didn't seem that different. And I guess I wouldn't say necessarily I learned that I can do it and that it's a fun thing and it's a pretty natural thing for me. And so I guess in that way, it was sort of, confidence boosting.
Would you have any advice for other writers or prospective book authors that are maybe trying to figure out how to crack the formula of a book like that?
Yeah. Again, you have to think of it as what story am I going to tell my audience and what. You know, in newspapers, we talk about what's the hook, what's the peg, but you have to do that for an entire book that's going to have many chapters. And so you're going to have to sustain the reader's interest over many different areas. I think the reason I like it so much is I have a real problem writing short things. I'm always pushing the word limit on a magazine assignment and trying to get that extra couple hundred words in. And so one of the things that I absolutely loved is just basically having free rein to go into as much detail as I wanted. I think you have to have very good reporting skills to gather enough information and detail to populate a book with really interesting material. It's easy to get a lot of material, but it may be less so to get really compelling material. Really doing a lot of research before you even put the proposal together. It's kind of a balancing act because you don't know that you're going to sell the book. So you don't want to invest way too much time into it. But if you don't invest a lot of time, you're not going to have enough, a rich enough line and proposal to hand to people. So it's kind of that digging down deep enough to know the subject well enough to know how you're going to tell the story, and then just logically laying it out chapter by chapter. So I would say spend a lot of time to write a really, really good proposal, because that's the blueprint that ideally you will follow that blueprint when you're writing the book. And then it's like you have your roadmap to the book. And if it's a good roadmap, then, you know, it's very easy to kind of flesh it out.
That's great advice. Yeah. And I know that submitting those proposals is, it in of itself is stressful. But then once you get the contract and they say, yes, this is a great idea, then the real stress begins. Mm-hmm. I'd like to connect this to something else that we talked about earlier, because I know that when one undergoes a lot of stress, it's really taxing on the body. It can really hurt things like your mental acumen, your immune system, and so on. And you had shared with me earlier that you have suffered a long time with lupus. And I'm wondering, how did the stress, the added stress of writing this book, such a large project, how did that affect you personally and your health? And how did you balance it all?
I haven't really shared this with many people, so no one has ever asked me this question. It's a really interesting one. First of all, I've had the disease for decades, and it is in a pretty good place right now. It's in remission. There was a period where I was extremely ill and I had to leave full-time journalism for about 10 years, but I have been fairly stable for quite a long time, almost to the point where I can sort of like not think I'm a person with a chronic disease, which is dangerous because I have to get blood drawn every 3 months and check to see how everything is going. So it's always in the back of my mind. I think what I would say is that over many, many years of having this disease, I've gotten much better at pacing myself and trying to remember that I need to have a certain amount of rest. I mean, if anything taxed me, I would say this last month and a half of, I think I logged 23,000 kilometers, and that's not even counting my Spain trip, just because there was so much crisscrossing of the country. In some ways, that was, I think, harder on my body. We did do 3 trips to Japan to do research, but they were pretty well planned out. You know, it was hard, but it was also incredibly fun and exciting. And I don't think you realize how tiring it is until you get back. So those were probably the most stressful parts of putting together the book. And then it just so happened that right as we were finishing up our last research trip to Japan is when sort of COVID arrived on the shores of Japan. The night before we were to fly out, we were going out to dinner with friends, and I was listening to NHK, the national news service, and this story broke about the Diamond Princess cruise ship docking in Yokohama Harbor, and it was a huge story. There were just nonstop coverage of it. And the country shut down right after our last trip. And we were so fortunate to have been able to do all our research. But once I got back to Canada, first of all, we couldn't even get into New York, where I would normally be spending a lot of time. So it was this enforced year and a half period where there wasn't a lot going on. And I just had to kind of hunker down and write the book. I felt a lot of pressure to meet the deadline, but it was also in a way an ideal scenario where there weren't a lot of distractions and it was just one thing I had to really focus on. And I think that was helpful in a way.
Well, we always try to look at the silver lining of any crisis. And when COVID hit, we were trying to help our industry to understand some of the things that they could be doing differently to not take advantage of the situation, but to cope with the situation, I think is really the best way to put it. It's funny because I think that, well, you're a perfect example where you had to focus on this book, and this book was birthed because of COVID. I mean, would you have necessarily written this book, or would you have done it so quickly if you didn't have a pandemic that had you locked down?
That's a good question. I think it would have been harder because there were would have been many more distractions. So it's hard to say what it would have looked like. Would I have met the deadline? I hope so, but who knows? But, you know, talking about advising the travel industry on how to handle COVID, Japan is a really interesting example because they were very hard on the restaurants and izakayas, the bars, so strictly locked down that it really hurt the industry a lot. And there was a lot of very upset people at the way there was sort of like this lack of understanding about the industry and how it needed to be supported. It's really hit the sake industry hard. And I think people, you know, it's a kind of an unprecedented thing, but I think that that kind of advice is really important. You have to support your local gastronomy in times of crisis in ways that are going to be safe for everyone, but also going to be allow people to make, you know, continue doing their businesses.
And travel itself is incredibly stressful, like you were saying. Now, did you have your Arrive Can app ready and waiting for your entry into Canada? Because we've heard a lot about how fantastic that app is.
It is really good. Actually, when we came back from the last research trip, they hadn't instituted Arrive Can yet. Now I use it all the time and it is really, really wonderful. I mean, every time I go to the airport, there are people who don't know about it or didn't fill it out. And so there's always a certain number of people who are standing at the check-in counter trying to figure out how to fill it out. But it is a really wonderful tool that streamlines your entry back into the country. And you just have to answer some questions online. You download the app onto your iPhone and then you upload it to the cloud and then they can see that you filled it out and you're just sort of expedited through. So it is really good.
So when you were back in Japan then, did you have a chance to have your, is it teishoku? Is that what it's called? The set meal?
No, we were kind of eating at a lot of sake bars. And then we were very fortunate to be invited into the homes of several noted brewing families. And it's usually the mother, the matriarch of the family, and sometimes several generation of women. There was one dinner we went to in Hiroshima where it was the mother of the president, the wife of the president, cooking together, having incredible multi-course meals that are home cooked, incorporating a lot of sake. It's not really a joke. I mean, I love eating simple Japanese food. So I kind of said my favorite meal would be a teishoku, which is a daily set meal of grilled fish, a bowl of rice, some miso soup, and pickles. So I do like to eat that kind of really simple food. I think it's because I go out a lot and I'm eating a lot of more elaborate restaurant food. So to me, that's just real comfort food. I may have had it once or twice on my travels, but often we're grabbing lunch at train stations or on the way to an interview. We did have some wonderful bowls of noodles and ramen and sushi along the way. Maybe a couple times.
Well, those are definitely great travel memories of meals. I have so many as well. But do you have a favorite food travel memory?
Well, I have a couple. One, I was reaching way back to when I was in college, because I think when you're really young, travel makes such a huge impact on you because I think when you're older and you've traveled to a lot of places, maybe the impact is not so huge, but I was in college still. I had studied in France for a semester and then I met up with friends and we had our Eurail pass and we were traveling all over Europe. And I think we must have been in Greece, but we just thought, what's the farthest we can go on this pass? So we just decided we're going to go to Istanbul and we didn't really know how far it was or how long it would take. But in my memory, it took like maybe 3 days because the trains were really local and very slow. It was very hot and very dusty. And it was kind of like we didn't really know what we're in for, but we just were on this train. And then we get to Istanbul and I was just amazed at what an incredible city it is. I mean, first of all, the people back then were so hospitable. Everywhere we went, we would get invited inside to shops by merchants and they would give us, it was very hot, but they would give us these little glasses filled with black tea. And just want to know, you know, who we were, where we were from, the food I had never had. It's all really simple. Like when you describe it, it doesn't seem like it could be that mind-blowing, but just a lot of meat and tomato-based stews. There was a ton of eggplant, which I love. The breads are incredible. I still love the pide, the Turkish flatbreads, and the borek, the little flaky pastries filled with ground meat and sometimes potatoes or vegetables. One funny thing, I was trying to search my memory for other things that I remember eating. It's such a big kebab culture. I don't really have a lot of memory. I mean, maybe we were too poor, I don't know, of eating the doner kebab, but I was in my cross-country travels. One really quirky thing I've come across is that Halifax is the donair capital of Canada. And the donair is kind of a sandwich that is adapted from the doner kebab. And apparently a Greek restaurateur brought it to Halifax and was doing the traditional lamb off of the rotating rotisserie, and people didn't go for the lamb, so they swapped in beef, but did the same, put it on a pita, and then they invented a much sweeter sauce than I think you would normally use, and it just took off. And now I think probably most Nova Scotians think it's, I mean, they probably have no idea that it's not a Canadian food. It's just like having a sub or a cheesesteak if you're in Philadelphia. That's just sort of a side tangent. The food in Istanbul was amazing. The hospitality. I remember we took a boat onto the Bosphorus Strait and just realizing that we were basically both in Asia and in Europe at the same time, that it was this real crossroads, that it was a city that was started by ancient Greeks as Byzantium and then was a Roman capital, but also a key stop on the Silk Road through Asia. It just was so exotic to me, and I really fell in love with it. And the sad kicker to the story is that I haven't been back there since, and I mean, I've been dying to go back ever since.
I have to agree with you on Istanbul. I had the good fortune of being able to travel there, although it was during the pandemic, but there was a conference I was asked to speak at, and I had never been to Istanbul, and I was really looking forward to going. And the food, they took us out to this restaurant on the first night, and wow, some of the best food I've ever had. I think that Turkish cuisine is really kind of underpromoted. I know it's different from other Levant cuisines and Greek food. There's some similarities, like there's baklavas and the coffees, but then there's a lot of differences too. And
Right.
I just don't think people know that much about Turkish food. It's a shame.
I absolutely agree. I mean, whenever I see a Turkish restaurant, there are a few in Manhattan. There's an area on the Upper East Side that traditionally has had a number. I always try to go because it is kind of similar but different, and I think really special and underappreciated or underrecognized, maybe.
And when we stayed there, we stayed at the Para Palace Hotel. Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't been back for so long. What's that like?
Well, it was a historic hotel property, and the colleague I was traveling with recommended that we stay there. And I said, okay, sounds good. So we stayed there, and it was a beautiful old style hotel. It's really quite interesting because now there is a series on Netflix called Para Palace, and I'm watching it really because I stayed there, and I could see you're walking in the halls, and it's kind of exciting. And they portray Istanbul of 100 years ago, right before World War I, and it's really interesting. Yeah, I have to say, I do kind of miss it a little bit. And the people, like you said, were just so friendly and hospitable.
Oh, you're making me want to go back more. Sounds great.
Okay, you can't say Japan for this one, but what's the next country or destination you'd really love to go to for food?
Well, we have a Vietnam trip that we've canceled at least or postponed at least two times because of COVID, and that's a country that I've been dying to go to for a very long time. I love the food. I mean, it is in Asia still, but I just find Southeast Asian cuisine to be so different and so beautiful and just really light and fresh in a way that Japanese food is not. As I mean, I love Japanese food, but if there's just that, all that herbal, all of the herbs that they put in the food, I just really love that and would love to. I have been to Thailand, love the food there, but I guess that's one that I would really like to go to. We're hoping to go to Morocco too, and I'm very excited about that because I've heard the food is wonderful there and I've never been there. So if all works out, I might get there in the fall.
Well, if you come visit me here in Spain, there is a hybrid Moroccan Spanish restaurant very close to where I live, and the food is excellent.
Oh,
I'll take you.
sounds great. Okay, great. I'm up for it.
Well, Nancy, I do hope that you can make it to Spain one day. But yeah, I have to agree with you. Morocco is a great destination. And Vietnam, I learned about Vietnamese food, although I've never been to the country. But there's a food vlogger rather, that I really like. His name is Sunnyside. And he has a show called The Best Ever Food Review Show. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek title. He's on YouTube and he's lived in Vietnam and he's done a lot of his episodes there. And that really opened up my eyes to the variety and richness of Vietnamese cuisines and ingredients and so on. And then we did one of our Taste of Place reports on it, and we really studied the culinary culture of the country and discussed that in the report. And wow, what an interesting history they have for their food.
Oh, I'm definitely going to look up Sunnyside on YouTube. It sounds great. Yeah, I think it's an amazing cuisine and I can't wait to go. I hope I get there.
I will send you the link to his show so you can have a look at it later, because he's a funny guy. And he kind of did during the pandemic, he did a lot of shows in Vietnam and Southeast Asia when he was able to travel, but he couldn't travel too far. But now he's back in the States and he's doing some different shows. So, but he's done a lot. He's done Azerbaijan and he went to Iran and India. And he really gets into the culture of the local people. I think you might find him really interesting.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Yeah. And just to travel to so many kind of under traveled places too is really interesting.
Yeah, we don't need another food show about San Francisco, do we?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, it's been such a delight chatting with you today. You have taught me many things, and one of which is really the new appreciation for sake. I've had it in Japanese restaurants and fish restaurants before, and I have always liked it, but I didn't really know what I was drinking. And you've really opened up my eyes there too. So I really appreciate the opportunity to learn from people like you who can teach me something and who can also teach our listeners something. So thank you for sharing all your knowledge and your experience with everyone in our industry.
It's been a pleasure to be here, Eric. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I just love your curiosity. It sparks really good conversations. And I learned a lot from you too. And it was just a really fun conversation. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks again, Nancy.
That's it for this episode of the Eat Well, Travel Better podcast. This episode is brought to you by the World Food Travel Association and its Culinary Capitals program. We'd like to hear from you regarding the podcast. We invite you to share your ideas, questions, and thoughts by emailing us at help@worldfoodtravel.org. Or you can connect with us and comment about the episode on major social media platforms. Special thanks to our guest, Natsu Matsumoto, and our thanks to you for joining us. I'm Eric Wolf, wishing you a safe, happy, and productive month ahead.